Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. One of the biggest motivators for the initial colonists leaving Europe was the thought of escaping religious persecution. Whether it be the Quakers, Protestants, Catholics, or some other religion, they were tired of having to defend their beliefs. And this was the basis for the Establishment Clause. This created a separation between the decisions the state would make and the influence of religion, trying to keep them autonomous. But what has this separation resulted in? Is it still something that we should be in favor of? And what happens if it starts to erode? Joining us now is Randall Balmer, John Phillips Professor in Religion at Dartmouth College, an Episcopal priest, and author of the book America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State. Welcome to the show, Professor Balmer.
Happy to be here, Amy.
So do you believe that the threat of religious persecution kept the Founding Fathers on track to institute the separation of church and state? Was that the basis of this all those hundreds of years ago?
I think that's a big part of it. They were very well aware of the religious contestation back in Europe and England, in Europe with the wars of religion and in England with the English Revolution. And they wanted to avoid that. And particularly, they wanted to avoid the impediments to the new government that might come from this sort of religious factionalism. And I think they were also aware, as you suggested in your introduction, they were also very much aware of the religious diversity already in the American colonies. When I do my religion in North America course, I put a image of the Atlantic colonies and asked the students to tell me the religious groups that settled there. And it's really quite a remarkable diversity. You have Puritans in New England, but you also have pilgrims who are different from the Puritans. In Rhode Island, you have Baptists under Roger Williams, and I expect we'll return to that subject here in our conversation. But in the middle colonies, you had Dutch Reform, you had Quakers, French Protestants known as Huguenots, Catholics, more Puritans, Presbyterians, and you go down even further to Delaware, you Swedish Lutherans, and then Anglicans in the South, various folk religions. And so part of the challenge facing the Founding Fathers was, how do you account for this diversity? How do you try to rein it in and make it manageable? And they decided, let's keep the government out of the religion business. And that's the genius, I think, of the First Amendment.
How do you feel that this separation of church and state that they had in the Establishment Clause, how has it shaped the United States we live in today, since that was one of the Founding Fathers' founding documents?
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that it is the First Amendment, right? Part of the Bill of Rights that was so important that it was number one. And I think the long arc of American history shows that it has worked remarkably well in shielding the government from this religious factionalism that the founders feared, but also for religion. And I say this as a person of faith. The First Amendment set up a free marketplace for religion, and it allowed various religious groups to compete with one another within that marketplace, with no one group enjoying the sanction of the state. And that marketplace has been vibrant and vital and salubrious throughout American history. So I think it's the best friend that religion has ever had.
Where does the actual name, the Establishment Clause, where does that come from? Using the word establishment, yeah.
Sure. It simply comes from the first phrase of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So those are 16 words, and the Establishment Clause is the first part of that phrase.
And I guess I never realized that it doesn't actually say the phrase separation of church and state. The Establishment Clause is written with different words. So how do you think we morphed it into this common, I mean, most people always, when you hear lawmakers talk about it, they talk about the separation of church and state. They don't say Establishment Clause.
They do, and this is one of the things that the people who are attacking the First Amendment are using, and they're saying, "Oh, look, the separation of church and state does not appear in the Constitution." Well, these same people tend to be so-called originalists in their approach to the Constitution, and the phrase "separation of church and state" comes actually first from Roger Williams, the founder of the Baptist tradition in America, but Thomas Jefferson repeats it in a letter to the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, that he wrote from the White House on New Year's Day, 1802, in which he said, "I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people that," and then he quotes the First Amendment and goes on to say, "thus establishing a line of separation between church and state." So that's where the phrase comes from. And for people who want to attack the First Amendment by saying that phrase is not in the Constitution, well, let's look at how the founders understood that. And Thomas Jefferson was certainly one of the founders, and the phrase comes from his pen.
Two of the ideas that went into the Establishment Clause were basically that government corrupted religion and religion corrupted government. Do you agree with that?
I do. And Roger Williams was the first person to see this in any vivid way. Roger Williams, as I said, was a Baptist, founder of the Baptist tradition in America, but he came over to the New World as a Puritan, and very quickly he ran afoul of the Puritan authorities who were trying to unite church and state. And so in 1644, Roger Williams writes this treatise called A Bloody Tenet of Persecution, in which he calls for separating the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world by means of a wall of separation. And I think we miss the power of that metaphor because we in the 21st century have romantic notions about wilderness. But Roger Williams was not a member of the Sierra Club. That is to say, he and his contemporaries did not have romantic ideas about wilderness. For them, wilderness was a place of darkness and danger where evil lurked. And so when Roger Williams talks about separating the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world, his principal concern was shielding the integrity of the faith from too close an association with the state.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the separation between church and state with Randall Balmer, professor in religion at Dartmouth College and an Episcopal priest. Professor, your book is titled America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State. So obviously, you're in favor of this if you called it the best idea. What worries you about the more recent intersection of religion and politics? What worries you about the separation going forward?
I think the First Amendment is under attack as perhaps no other time in our history, and I can talk about various times it has been under attack in the past. But we have a Supreme Court today that has little regard for the First Amendment. And I sometimes say I wish the Supreme Court had half as much deference toward the First Amendment, separation of church and state, as it does for the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. They're very big on the Second Amendment and very bad on the First Amendment. So that worries me, and it worries me, again, from both angles. That is to say, it worries me because I don't think religious affairs should be part of the government, which is not to say that people of faith should not express themselves in the arena of public discourse. I'm not saying that at all. But it worries me also from the perspective of the faith and the potential for corrupting the faith. And let me give you a quick example of that. I'm sure that you and many of your listeners will remember the Alabama Ten Commandments case in 2001, when the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, plopped this granite monument in the lobby of the judicial building in Montgomery, emblazoned with the Ten Commandments, and at the same time steadfastly refused any other religious representations in that space. I happened to have been one of the expert witnesses in that case in challenging the constitutionality of the Ten Commandments monument. And when Judge Thompson ruled correctly that the monument violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and ordered the monument removed, one of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God." And if I'm not mistaken, one of those commandments says something about graven images. And that, I think, was precisely Roger Williams' point about the danger in trivializing and fetishizing the faith by having it too closely associated with the state.
You mentioned earlier that the original colonists had lots of different religions. Like, there were a lot of different religions packed into those very, very small space compared to the whole United States now. But looking at today, is there a specific sect of Christianity that the Trump administration is pulling ideas from, or that the country, not just the Trump administration, but all around the country, Christianity seems to be lumped together? It's not as separated as it was back in the days of the colonies. Do you agree?
Well, yes, it's lumped together, at least in the public consciousness, but there are a lot of different expressions of Christianity still around, that's for sure. But you're pointing, I think, to some of the loudest voices that are, ironically, in my judgment, trying to tear down this wall of separation. And to be honest, Amy, I'm actually flummoxed by this, and I mean that sincerely. The First Amendment, as I said earlier, is the best friend that religion has ever had. And why the people who claim to be defenders of the faith are trying to jettison the First Amendment and the separation of church and state is, to me, unfathomable. And the particular group that is most vociferous about this, and we're talking really about white evangelicals or the religious right, they are the ones who have benefited most from the separation of church and state. That is to say, evangelicalism, and I grew up as an evangelical, I understand this world, I think, very well. Evangelicalism knows almost instinctively how to speak the idiom of the culture. And they have been enormously successful throughout American history in competing in this free marketplace of the First Amendment. And why they would want to tear this down is, to me, genuinely perplexing.
You talked about the you gave the example of the case in Alabama with the Ten Commandments. The battleground for a lot of state versus church debates happens in the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. Are there any landmark cases from the past? I mean, we can get into the today's court in a minute, but are there any landmark cases in the past you feel have defined the debate between the two?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think in the whole record of the court, the Everson case back in the 1940s is an important case. The school prayer rulings in the 1960s, as well as the ruling that outlawed the mandatory reading of the Bible in public schools, that was a very important case. And that, of course, created a huge backlash on the part of many conservative folks, and leading to another attempt on the part of some people to amend the Constitution to include all sorts of Christian language into the Constitution. Fortunately, that has been turned away. But it's still a matter of contestation. There's no question about that.
Are there any current cases working their way through the court that you're watching related to this?
I haven't kept up on the current cases. The most recent cases that I find quite troublesome are the Montana Espinoza case, as well as the main case in the Macon decision that allows for the use of taxpayer money for religious education. And that, Amy, has always been a very bright line in this separation of church and state. Going back to the 19th century, the so-called Blaine Amendments. James Blaine was a member of Congress from Maine who became Speaker of the House and later went to the Senate and later became Secretary of State. And he proposed an amendment that would outlaw the use of public funds or taxpayer money for religious education. It did not pass Congress. It passed the House, but not the Senate. And then 37 states adopted some version of the Blaine Amendment in order to prohibit the use of taxpayer money for religious education. And the Supreme Court essentially leveled that barrier in the Espinoza case and the Macon case. And now you have several states with Republican majorities, places like Iowa, Florida, Oklahoma, and so forth, that are trying to jump into that gap and use taxpayer money for the support of religious education.
Mm. Yeah, here in Ohio, we use public money for vouchers, and those can be used for private education, and which can be religious. But I think there's a distinction there, I guess, whenever it's a voucher versus the state money going directly, because you can pick what private school, right?
Yes, it's yes. Actually, after Ohio passed the voucher case for one of my previous books called Thy Kingdom Come, I went to visit some of these schools in Cleveland to write about this. And, my opinion is no more favorable today than it was then.
Well, we'll talk more about that in a minute, because a lot of these cases of separation of church and state end up relating to public schools. So staying with us after the break is Randall Balmer, John Phillips Professor in Religion at Dartmouth College and an Episcopal priest. And coming up, we're going to talk more about religion being used in modern politics. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Undercutting countless political debates of the last 50 years in American politics is how far can the state go against the church? Recently, however, there has been more explicit cases of merging church and state, such as bringing the Ten Commandments into public schools, and politicians using Christian ideology and imagery to convey their points. Is this signaling a shift toward a more secular nation, or will the religious fervor die down? Should people of other faiths be worried about how they should express themselves? Still with us is Randall Balmer, John Phillips Professor in Religion at Dartmouth College, an Episcopal priest, and author of the book America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State. More than just explicit Supreme Court rulings, the U.S. government has recently been using Christian imagery and values in Trump administration movements. So how would you say this ties into the Establishment Clause if they're actually using religious imagery? I mean, everything, you know, President Trump even had his own branded Bibles. So how does that?
Right.
Yes. What do you think of that whenever you have an image like that, where like the president of the United States is using Christian imagery?
I think it's very troubling. And what really disturbs me is kind of the bigger picture here, Amy. That is to say, I consider myself a patriot. I don't make any bones about that. Probably not in a flag waving sense or wearing red caps or things like that. But my sense of patriotism derives from my sense that the long arc of American history, we as Americans have been trying to live into the principles that are articulated in our charter documents far too slowly, particularly in regard to people of color, women, Native Americans as a whole story into itself. But generally, we've tried to live into those principles. And one of the principles in our charter documents is that we are not a majoritarian society, which is to say, we are not a society that allows the majority to dictate the terms of life to everyone else. We protect the rights of minorities. The charter documents provide for that. Again, we've lived into it imperfectly, and I don't deny that. But let's suppose for a moment that all of a sudden, a majority of Americans decided to become vegetarians. Unlikely to understand that, but or Masons or Christadelphians or whatever it might be. And they decided that, hey, we're a majority. We can tell everybody else in the country how to live. And that's the peril, I think, of this majoritarian movement that is trying now to install all these Christian symbols in various public places. And by the way, why the Ten Commandments? If these are Christian nationalists, and they do claim to be Christian nationalists, why not the Sermon on the Mount? Why not the Beatitudes? I mean, that's arguably more Christian even than the Ten Commandments. Or why not Matthew 25, where Jesus tells his followers to care for the least of these and to welcome the stranger? That seems to me would be more appropriate if you're really a Christian nationalist.
What do you think leaders of other religions feel right now with this, like, Christian majority seemingly trying to take over from the top down? I mean, if you're sitting there as someone who is Muslim or Jewish or any religion, what do you feel as a professor of religion, you know, for those other religions?
Oh, sure. I think there's no question these folks feel imperiled. And, you know, I'm a Christian. I make no bones about that. As you noted, I'm an Episcopal priest. I should be cheering for the home team, but I don't think that's the way to go. I really don't, because, as I said earlier, I think that compromises both the integrity of the faith as well as the stability of the state.
Do you see this movement towards Christianity as a genuine movement of religious passion, or do you see it as something else?
I think it's become so politicized that I almost can't recognize it. As I said earlier, I grew up as an evangelical. I have strong ties and strong feelings, very much in sympathy with evangelicalism in many, many ways, certainly theologically. But I can barely recognize the movement that I grew up in the 20th century. It has become so crassly politicized. And one of the things I've tried to do in my writings, not so much in this book, but in other works, is to call evangelicals back to, first of all, the words of Jesus in the New Testament, who told his followers to care for the least of these, to welcome the stranger, to visit the prisoner and try to care for those who are on the margins of society, but also to reacquaint them with their own heritage in American life. You look at evangelicalism in the 19th and even into the 20th century, evangelicals almost unanimously worked for those on the margins of society. They were involved in prison reform. They were involved in the women's equality movement, including voting rights for women in the 19th century. It was a radical idea at the time. They were very much involved in public schools, public education, because they understood that education was a way for those on the lower rungs of society to become upwardly mobile. That, to me, is a true expression of the faith and quite noble and worthy. And that has been almost entirely lost, I think, with the emergence of the religious right in the late 1970s.
What do you think, you know, with this emergence of the religious right, with the Establishment Clause? So, you want to say that with conservatives, you know, holding on to the Constitution and believing in the Constitution and what our Founding Father says goes hand in hand, but at the same point, they want more Christianity into the state. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I don't. I think it's an utter contradiction. Mm-hmm. To step back and take the historian's angle here, I sort of understand it. I understand the impulse. That is to say, I think what happened beginning in the late 70s is that evangelicals kind of looked around and said, wait a minute, we no longer have a majority. Well, we may have a majority, but we no longer have a kind of hegemonic hold on American life and American society. And that goes back further to the counterculture movement in the 1960s, but also I identify the Immigration Act of 1965 as being a turning point. That is a point when the immigration barriers were leveled, the quotas were eliminated, and all of a sudden you had various folks coming in from Asia and South Asia with their religious views and their religious practices that looked very different from the practices of Protestant Christians. And so I think by the late 1970s, even though the real catalyst of the religious right was a defense of racial segregation in places like Bob Jones University, what added to their unease was a sense that we are no longer calling the shots in the society. And I think the agenda of the religious right is really trying to sort of rewrite history, but also try to rewrite laws that so that they can have a competitive advantage in this marketplace of religion in America. So I do understand the impulse, but I think it's misguided and ultimately quite destructive.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the separation between church and state with Randall Balmer, professor in religion at Dartmouth College. This year, Oklahoma legislators were trying to push mandatory Bible lessons in school, and they wanted to use President Trump's own branded Bibles for those lessons. So,
imagine that.
Yeah, imagine. But so, but what do you think about, you know, putting Bibles in schools is one thing, but if it's the Bible of the President of the United States, how does that factor into this church and state situation?
Oh, I mean, I think there's all sorts of tripwires in that, in that initiative, particularly when you're using it to favor a particular political movement or a political candidate. But you know, the issue of using the Bible in public schools is a complicated one. I would be the last person to deny that the Bible has been important in Western civilization and certainly even in the history of American life. But there's a difference, I think, in teaching the Bible from teaching about the Bible. And if this sort of instruction devolves into a kind of catechism, I think that's a clear violation of the Establishment Clause and the separation of church and state. But on the other hand, I think there's certainly a place for people or in teachers to talk about the importance of the Bible in American life, so long as it does not degenerate into some form of proselytizing.
I mean, I don't expect you to follow Ohio politics closely, but here in Ohio, there's been a lot of back and forth about religious release programs in schools. So whether whether a public school should allow students to leave the public school to attend a religious program for like a part of the day. The state ended up requiring all school districts to have a policy related to it, and those policies vary. But for the most part, it does allow this. The districts will say, yes, you know, you can leave school. They limit the number of hours and how many times a week and that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on this type of way, that way of getting religion in schools by taking our kids out of school?
I suppose, well, what you described to me sounds like what you have in Utah with the Mormons. They have similar sorts of arrangements there, although the religious instruction takes place before the school day, so gets the kids up very early in the morning to do that religious instruction. I suppose if it were a separate mode of education, like it is in Utah, I would have no objection to it. But if it takes away from real education instruction, I think that's problematic. And, you know, we have public education is in trouble in this society. There's no question about that. But I don't think the answer is to baptize it with religious ideas or religious principles.
When you wrote your book, America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State, did you hear from pastors around the country who were saying, you know, like, hey, wait, you're religious, you're an Episcopal priest, why are you saying this is the best idea?
Not specifically. I expect I will. The book is just out fairly recently, and it's actually going to be on the New York Times bestseller list this weekend, found out.
So. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm sure I will hear from those folks. There's no question about that. But, you know, I think my argument has been very consistent, in fact, throughout my career, that the First Amendment is America's best idea, and I stand by that, both for politics and for our common life together as Americans, but also for people of faith, that keeping the state out of religion is the best solution, I think, for everybody.
Do you think that the integration between church and state and these more blurred lines recently, especially with politics, have led to more people engaging with their faith, though? Do you feel like people are more devoted Christians because they're hearing about it in politics from the administration, etc.?
I don't follow polls very much, but what I'm hearing from pollsters is the opposite is happening. That is, people are turning away from organized religion because it's become so crassly politicized over the last several decades. And I think there's probably something to that. And this gets back, I think, to Roger Williams and his concern about protecting the garden of the church from the wilderness of the world. So no, I don't think that's happening. I think there's people are becoming more fervent politically and in the political arena. I don't think there's any question about that. But whether or not that leads to a redoubling of their faith or reinforcing their faith, frankly, I would have my doubts.
What do you think of the end game here for people who want to blur the lines between church and state, want to basically go against the First Amendment? Are they just wanting the United States to be a Christian nation, the end?
Yeah, that's their stated goal. I think there's no question about that. And these are people who argue that America always was or should have been a Christian nation. There's even crazy arguments out there that something like 53 of the 55 founders were Orthodox Christians, which certainly would, presumably would include people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. And that's just, that's ludicrous. And in terms of the end game, I think there's a spectrum. I think at one end you have people who say, well, we should outlaw same-sex marriage, but then you have also people who say we should outlaw divorce. We should, the more radical folks want to rewrite American civil and criminal law according to what they call biblical principles, which they tend to gravitate to Leviticus for some reason. They love Leviticus and want to rewrite American laws in accordance with Leviticus, which is, well, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, everyone's favorite book of the Bible. We'll save Leviticus for another time.
I think so, yes.
All right. Well, let's end our time today with, I guess, the opposite question. For you, you've written the book on it. What is your ideal idea of the relationship between church and state to you?
Well, I think it's what the founders prescribed. That is that they're two separate entities and each is allowed to function freely. And again, I want to reiterate what I said earlier. This does not mean that people of faith cannot express themselves in the arena of public discourse. I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I think public discourse would be impoverished without these voices of faith. But we also have to be aware of the dangers of majoritarianism. We also have to be aware that we need to protect the rights of minorities, that they should be allowed to express themselves in the arena of public discourse also, and their rights are protected. That, I think, is what the founders had in mind.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. Randall Balmer, professor of religion at Dartmouth College, an Episcopal priest, and the author of the book, America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State. Thank you so much for your time today, professor.
My pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk more about this potential merging of church and state, and we'll talk specifically about a few things here in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With 64% of Ohioans registering as some type of Christian, many believe that combining the church and the state is not much of a merger, just a complementary guide. The Pledge of Allegiance even has the phrase, "One Nation Under God," within it. And yet, the same founders preached for a separation between church and state. Are there benefits to bringing aspects of the church into every American's life? And was the nation ever fully separated to begin with? Joining us now is Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of the Ohio Christian Education Network. Welcome back to All Sides, Aaron.
Great to be with you, Amy.
What is your take on the separation of church and state? Do you believe it's an important clause in the Constitution?
Oh, goodness me. It's one of the most important. It's something we definitely believe in. And I should say, let me back up here. The word separation of church and state, first and foremost, are not in the Constitution.
Right.
What you're referring to is the First Amendment that says there shall not be the establishment of religion. Mm-hmm. And even just the opening there, talking about our founders believed in the separation of church and state. When Thomas Jefferson wrote those words in his letter, he was referring to keeping the government out of the church's business, not keeping Christian voice and influence from the government. I don't know any Christian, and I run the largest Christian organization in Ohio. I don't know any Christian that wants to put the church, as in the Church of England or something like that in Ohio or in the United States, under the auspices of the government. What we want to see, as we want to see with everybody, is that if you have a voice and you're a Christian, you should be using that voice to influence good public policy and good direction for the country. It's a complete misnomer. It's why we say the separation of church and state is a myth. The idea that there's Christians out there in a serious way saying we need to establish a Church of America or something like that under the government's control, that would be a disaster. But it's a good thing that we have significant Christian voices involved in our government. And it's a phenomenal thing that the people who founded our country were strong Christians that built our country on incredible principles that value the dignity of every single life.
Do you feel like there has been, especially in more recent years, more of a blurring between religion and politics? Meaning like it seems like there's more Christians in American politics today.
I don't see any data that would reflect that. I see really scare quotey names like Christian nationalism and things like that getting tossed around to try to say and bully Christians from using their voice in politics, just like any American can use their voice in politics. But the idea that somehow there's this merger of church and state happening today is so fantastical and nonsensical that it can't be seen as anything other than just political rhetoric.
There's been a lot of talk about the way religion, specifically Christianity, is going in and out of schools, public schools. That's where a lot of this debate comes from. What are your feelings on other religions making their way into schools versus Christianity?
Well, I think we need to first step back and say, why do we have public schools in Ohio? And the reality was because a bunch of Baptist ministers from Massachusetts decided they wanted to start a state in the Northwest Territory. And they founded a state on the ideas of religion, morality, and knowledge are essential for good government. And they wanted to establish a state that valued literacy. They wanted value literacy because they wanted people to, in many ways, to be able to read the Bible for themselves and access the truth. And that's why we have a state that values education and values literacy. And from the very founding of our state, understanding that Christianity was a good force has been a part of our public education system. There's actually been people that are trying to force out honest conversation and open dialogue about Christianity and other faiths. But the idea that somehow we're trying to turn our public schools into churches is nonsense.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Ohio politics related to religion. Vivek Ramaswamy is a Republican, yeah, and he's running to be Ohio's governor. He was recently at a Turning Point USA event, and someone in the crowd questioned his religion. Ramaswamy is Hindu. Let's listen.
In my faith, I believe there's one true God. He resides in all of us, and he appears in different forms, but it's one true God. So I'm an ethical monotheist. That's the way I would describe my faith. Now, I will tell you, I'm not running to be pastor of Ohio. I'm running to be governor of Ohio, and I didn't run to be pastor of America. I ran to be president of the United States of America.
basically the back and forth with that person in the audience, the person was asking him, why should Christians vote for someone with Hindu beliefs? So what's your response to that?
Oh, I love that question. I especially love it as a leader of a large Christian organization who has personally endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy as a Hindu, knowing he's a Hindu, to be the next governor. I think at the end of the day, politics is the art of deciding the direction of our country. What are the right things for us to do and the wrong things for us to do? And Vivek is aligned on the most important issues today. He's come to a lot of these conclusions apart from a biblical worldview, but he's come to the right conclusions about the nature of humanity, the nature of work, the nature of the value of every human life, the importance of education. And so when we look at, as Christians, as voters, our vote is our ability to say, this is the direction we want to go, and this is the person that's going to execute that vision for us. It's a very clear answer that Vivek is the best one to get that done for us. Now, I will say, I pray, and I've told Vivek this, we've had great conversations about faith. I pray for Vivek, one, that he'd be successful, but also that he'd fall in love with Jesus as I have and the 64% of Ohioans, as you said. But just because he's not a Christian doesn't mean he can't do great public policy. And also, I think, really cast a real shadow on the idea that Christian nationalism is about getting Christians to take over all things in Ohio or America today.
Now, the back and forth went on for a long time between Ramaswamy and this person in the audience. But basically, I feel like he was asking, you know, like, why am I supporting you? We used to have a Christian candidate in the race. So Dave Yost was a Christian. So why not pick him?
Oh, Dave Yost, I have utmost respect for. He's a dear friend. He's a strong brother in Christ. Again, the question is, that when we're going to vote, right, the buck stops with the voters in America today. So when we go to vote, we have to ask ourselves, who is the person that's going to best execute on uplifting righteousness and driving things forward? Not just who's the best one I want to be in a Bible study with, not just who's the best one who has a really strong faith in Jesus. It's who's going to be able to execute on the public policies that we believe are best for our country. And I believed that Vivek Ramaswamy, with his courage, being an outsider, with his platform and his vision for the state, was the best one to do that for us. And that's the question. Again, that's the whole thing. People always wanted to criticize Christians over voting for Donald Trump because he has such an, he's done some awful things in his past around his marriages and even some things like that. But at the end of the day, who was the best one to guide the country between Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or Kamala Harris? It was very clearly Donald Trump when you actually look at the policies and the directions we want to go.
Back to this, the original, you know, context here of the separation of church and state and the Establishment Clause. Do you think people who are Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, do you think that they feel like maybe Christianity is getting preferential treatment? That seems to be the heavy focus of a lot of our politics. It relates to Christianity.
I can't speak to any of those, but you look at the most recent U.S. Supreme Court cases. Take the Mahmoud case, right, where the question was, can a family opt out of sexually explicit materials and sex education. That was brought by a Muslim family, right? And Jewish families got involved in that, and Christian families got involved in that, right? That's the beauty of the First Amendment, is that it protects people of all faith. But just like for Christians, every individual in America has the right to vote according to their conscience or their values. And if your conscience is formed by the Holy Spirit, that doesn't make your vote any less valid, as opposed to if your conscience was formed by the Quran or by Bill Maher and Sam Harris, right? It's all equally valid in the eyes of the Constitution. And I will say, people should want Christians to be involved, because Christians fundamentally believe that every individual matters, that every individual has value, and that our country actually is best positioned when we respect the value of the individual.
Earlier in the show, we talked with a professor who's written a new book. It's called America's Best Idea, The Separation of Church and State. Would you agree with the premise of that book? It's one of America's best ideas?
Absolutely not. It's one of America's most manipulated ideas, again, because the way he's talking about separation of church and state is not the actual conversation in the First Amendment, not the actual idea behind the First Amendment in the first place, and also unbelievably mischaracterizes what Christians like myself are actually trying to do. Again, the idea that we're trying to set up the Church of America just like the Church of England is nonsensical. No one's having that conversation. But what we are doing is the same thing that Zohran Mamdani is doing in New York right now. No one's No one's accusing Mamdani of being a Muslim nationalist. But tell me, what's the difference between Mamdani saying, hey, I'm going to take my Muslim values and I'm going to allow my Muslim values to influence the decisions I would make as mayor, and me or anybody else, or J.D. Vance saying, hey, I'm going to allow my Christian values to shape the decisions I make as a leader. That's not nationalism. That's just the way the system works.
Well, the president of the United States does have his own branded Bibles. I mean, that's something. If the you don't want it to be you don't want it to be the Church of America, but the president has a Bible.
Right. That's it in his private life, I will say. Right. That those are not state issued Bibles. Right. There's a lot of things that people do in their private lives that don't have to do with the way that they're governing the state. He's not issuing those Bibles for every kid to read in public schools.
Well, Oklahoma wanted them to be in their schools. They wanted Bibles in the schools and they wanted them to be the Trump branded Bibles.
So by all means, again, having Bibles in the schools isn't a bad thing. That's a great thing. It's one of the most important historical books in all of human history. Why wouldn't we want to be reading those things?
But having the president, you say it's in his private life, but the president doesn't have a private life. Wouldn't you agree?
I mean, yes and no. But again, it's such a nonsensical framing of the issue. If he's not printing these from America and saying everybody has to be a Christian. That's not Christian nationalism. That's Donald Trump being Donald Trump with a business and pushing out Bibles.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the separation of church and state with Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of the Ohio Christian Education Network. Vice President J.D. Vance is a Christian, and he's spoken about how he used to be an atheist, but is now a Christian, and he's raising his kids Christian. His wife is Hindu. Here is J.D. Vance talking at an event recently.
We decided to raise our kids Christian. As I've told her, and I've said publicly, and I'll say now in front of 10,000 of my closest friends, do I hope eventually that she is somehow moved by the same thing that I was moved in by church? Yeah, I honestly do wish that. Because I believe in the Christian gospel, and I hope eventually my wife comes to see it the same way. But if she doesn't, then God says everybody has free will, and so that doesn't cause a problem for me.
So I feel like, there's a line here between religion and politics and the vice president's marriage, you know, telling thousands of people and the internet that you wish your wife would change her beliefs. What would you say to the second lady?
Oh, my gosh. I would say the same thing that J.D. said to her. That is, there's a creator God who loves you so much that he sent his only son to die for you, and that he desperately wants you to follow him and has so many blessings for you. And if she decides not to, like JD said, then that doesn't mean God loves her any less, but that's her decision there. This is one of these things, I don't understand the controversy over this one bit. You know, we want our politicians to speak honestly and to speak as people, our leaders, to just talk like people. And of course, if you believe as I do, that God is the creator God and Jesus loves everybody and has a way and truth and a life for all of us, why wouldn't you want that for somebody? That's the greatest gift in my life, the greatest thing that I have. Why wouldn't I want that for my wife or my friends or and for you, Amy? Like, that's the thing that everybody wants if you have a gift so great. So I don't understand what the issue here of him talking honestly about just the real dynamic between him and his beautiful, amazing, intelligent wife.
There's been big battlegrounds between church and state in the classroom. The previous guest we talked about was talking specifically about like hanging the Ten Commandments in schools. And he wondered why we don't hang the Beatitudes or, you know, different parts of the Bible in schools rather than the Ten Commandments. What do you say to that? That there's other parts of the Bible that are even more Christian than the Ten Commandments?
Well, it's kind of hard to say what's more or less Christian. I think the Ten Commandments are pretty Christian.
Yeah.
So I say a few things. We support these bills that talk about hanging the Ten Commandments. I think what's important about the Ten Commandments is it has a really rich history in understanding where the law came from, where the concept of law, the concept of inherent dignity and rights comes from, right? That there is an order to society and a way that we should order our lives that has purpose, that makes us all interact well together. Things like don't steal, don't kill, don't commit adultery, things like that. These are don't covet, right? These are foundational ideas that have actually formed a lot of Western thought today, right? So, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about public education in America, we think all of a sudden, out of nowhere, 250 years ago, this whole concept popped up. But there's a long, rich history that started through Judaism all the way through Christianity that built us here. And our education system should be building upon that, not tearing it down. So that's the whole conversation around the Ten Commandments. Hey, this is really the beginning of the law that our tradition in America, in the way we have our separation of powers and government we have today, is built upon. And it's an important historical document for us to understand, as we're really trying to understand how, hey, why all of a sudden in 1776 and then in the Constitution, we have these ideas that all men are created equal. Where did that come from? Endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, where did these come from? There's a direct line back to the Ten Commandments on that. That's important for people to understand.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you for your time. We've been talking with Aaron Baer, president of the Center for Christian Virtue and founder of the Ohio Christian Education Network. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Amy.
And I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, student producers Iza Huck, Colin Simpson, and Kiara Burson. And I want to say a special thank you to Colin Simpson for producing the show today. Video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And if you missed any part of today's show, listen back at WOSU.org/allsides, subscribe to the podcast, or listen in our free mobile app. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.